This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. Malaysia is expected to become an ageing nation in just a few decades, but how prepared are we to meet the needs of our ageing population? And what can research do to inform policymakers? On today's show, we'll look at the development of the field of gerontology and the role it plays in bridging the gaps in policy, research and practice. Joining me on the show today to answer these questions is Chai Sin Ting. He is a senior research officer with the Malaysian Research Institute on Ageing from University Putra, Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Chai.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. So tell me more about what gerontology is. You know, how does it differ from the field of geriatrics?
It's as the name says, geriatrics. Like pediatrics is a medicine for older persons, a specialization in medicine. But gerontology is actually comes from the root word of gero and logy, which is the study of. So the study of old age is gerontology. It is actually a multidisciplinary field of study. So it's not just health, but it encompasses economics, psychology, sociology, as well as engineering and design, architecture. So all these are part of the field.
Right. And just when we look at the gerontology field here, you know, are we properly equipped with adequate resources? You know, how developed is this field locally?
Of course, competitions for grant is scarce, especially for the social sciences. But the government has centralized funding for research, and researchers will have to bid for them. So while we have a national policy for older persons, as far back as 1995, research grants has always been on a more competitive with the other fields. They don't really say, I'm going to dedicate a sum for gerontological studies. There's no such initiative at the moment. But in recent years, there are more and more ministerial fundings for aging studies. For example, last year there were two major research that was completed under ILMIA and Ministry of Health as well as Ministry of Human Resources, where they study about employment in old age. That's one. And the other one is the Institut Kesihatan Umum, where they studied about health of older persons. So I think those two studies are completed. And the ministries have more funding now to actually contract out research on different aspects on aging. The institute, my institute, have completed two studies in 2017 on facilities and services for older Malaysians, looking at needs for residential and non-residential facilities. And there was also a review of the financial assistance programs under the Department of Social Welfare. So in recent years, there are more direct government funding, but it's still through an open tender process. Researchers will have to put in a bid. And but the research structure, the traditional structure to the Ministry of Science and Technology is still the same.
Right.
You have fundamental research grants, you have long-term research grants. Those are all on the level field. You just put in your proposal.
So in terms of limitations for this field, it's mainly funding, I'm assuming.
Definitely. Funding, equipments, for example. It is very, very hard for us to catch up in some fields to the more advanced studies in the West. But what we need to remember is that every country have a different context, especially in terms of a social protection system and healthcare structure. So we need research, we need data, but perhaps more importantly, we need more transparency in and access to what we call administrative data, big data. For example, we have a lot of data in terms of pension from the Jabatan Perkhidmatan Awam, JPA. Pension data is very well recorded. We have EPF data, for example. These are administrative data, big data that can be very, very useful if we mine them, if we use them, But unfortunately, we still have a lot of red tape in accessing these sensitive data. But even major regular surveys, such as under the Department of Statistics, where you have the census data and you also have the household income and expenditure surveys, they also yield very, very useful information for researchers. But the access is spotty. We have access, but probably there are limitations and subsamples that we can get.
And we know that Malaysia is expected to become an aging nation in just a few decades, as I mentioned earlier. So research has predicted that by 2020, I think, that those aged 65 and above will represent 7% of the population, and that by 2045, Malaysia will become an aged nation. So that leaves us with only, I think, 26 years to go. Is that enough time for us to prepare for that?
This is where it gets really interesting. Countries like France, US, or Sweden, their transition to an aged nation status is probably 50, 60 to 100 years. In the case of France, it's about 114 years. So for them, it started 7% was probably way back in the 1800s. And it took them about 100 over years to slowly transition into 14%. Of course, now it's way higher than that. But they had time. And they were rich before they were old. And that's the expression that we use in the United Nations. And most developing countries today, like Thailand and Vietnam and Malaysia included, we are not so lucky. You know, we probably have a transition window of less than 30 years. And after we are fully transitioned into an aged society or aged nation, our economy has not really caught up with that. And this is where the risk is for economists, for demographers, to really understand what kind of impact that we will face when we have such a rapid pace of aging. It is really caused by declining fertility at the population level. Mm. So it is related. It is not an isolated case where we are saying that people are not dying off. Right. I mean, we do have an increase in life expectancy. But that is not the real reason why we are aging so rapidly as a whole. It is actually because of falling fertility rates.
Mm. So that's what differentiates us from countries like France, for example.
Correct. Mm. They are, in Japan, the situation is even more severe, where the total population is actually decreasing annually. And older persons make up about almost nearly 30%, one-third of their population. If you use 65, it's probably about 20%+. But if you use 60 as the cutoff, that's almost 30%. Mm. So in situation like that, we have to rethink our approach to employment. I mean, retiring at the age of 60 is probably a luxury for those countries because they will have labor shortages. And these are the issues that every country will have to think about. But it is not all bad news. You know, it is really about managing success. I mean, it's a good problem to have. But at the same time, different population structure would mean that we need to rethink our approach to pension. We need to rethink our approach to healthcare. We have to figure out whether it is more efficient to have pension systems where we need to reform them so that everyone will have some kind of a minimum income in older age, as whether it is through contributory schemes or non-contributory schemes. And this is what ILO was talking about when they say that we need a social protection floor for everyone, regardless of their age.
And when we talk about our preparedness, you know, in terms of financial independence, social issues, you know, where do we stand? You know, how would you assess our preparedness to meet those needs?
I think research data and past studies on adequacy of retirement savings has shown us that relying on EPF alone is not going to be sufficient. But it also falls back on the kind of assumptions that we are making about lifestyle needs and comfort. So, and also, of course, inflation. I mean, cost of living is increasing all the time. So it would be unfair to say that the solution might just be increase the contributions and savings for retirement. But that will have a different impact altogether. And in Malaysia, we rarely talk about redistribution and we rarely talk about risk pooling. And it is actually very strange that we have been talking about a national health insurance for years, but we didn't really get what we were looking for, a sustainable way of funding universal health care for all. And now we are looking at pension reforms, you know, and these are the things that whether there's such a political will and whether there is a public support for reforms that will have to take place.
Mm.
A very easy example would be we have revised the minimum age of retirement, whether it's public or private, to 60. And for private, it was done in 2012. That was when the act was passed.
Right.
But the EPF withdrawal age is still at 55.
Mm.
There's a lot of public resistance to changing the withdrawal age. It is understandable because people would feel that, hey, it's my money. I have plans for them. But EPF is really money for your retirement, not pre-retirement. So in a way, we need to balance our individual needs and with policy planning, because we have already known that giving out lump sums are not sustainable measures. So the question here is not about saying, let's make decisions and ignore public opinion. No, but we probably could come and meet everyone halfway. We need to have public engagements. If we talk about the high number of civil servants resulting in high government pension burden, those issues can be resolved together. If we envision that civil servants will ultimately contribute to their own pension funds, then there is justification to say perhaps the private sector EPF will be changed into a pension scheme where when you retire, a portion of the funds will be converted to a monthly pension for the rest of your life with government minimum or ceilings. And that's exactly what Singapore did with CPF. And that's why they have CPF Life now. You can't really withdraw all your money from your CPF. You must have a balance.
Yeah.
And that balance will be converted to a monthly pension. But do we have the political will and public support for such initiatives? That's something that we have to discuss.
Mm. I'm speaking to Chai Sen Ting. He is the Senior Research Officer from the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging from University Putra, Malaysia. We are talking about the role of gerontology in bridging gaps in policy. We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we will continue to talk about our preparedness to meet the needs of our aging population in other areas. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. I am speaking today to Chai Sen Ting. He is a Senior Research Officer from the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging, University Putra, Malaysia. We are talking about the role of gerontology in bridging gaps in policy. And before we went for the break, we were talking about the financial preparedness for the aging community here and what we can do about that. But what about, you know, when it comes to going back into the workplace, where does Malaysia stand in terms of our preparedness for that?
There are recent developments on saying that perhaps the retraining funds under the HRDF could be utilised for workplace re-entry. That is something that we need to have in the long run. But the real issue here is that when we increased the minimum retirement age in 2012 to 60, we can see that there is a significant increase in the labour force participation rate for that age group. But after the age of 60, it remains normal. The pattern is the same. So there wasn't really any benefit felt after that. So we cannot keep adjusting the retirement age to 65, to 70, because it is a little bit difficult because you will have many other factors at play. Health, for example. And these are issues at the workplace where seniority matters more than performance, or whether the elderly themselves, workers, are willing to take a pay cut in a different role. So all these would come under the research area where we say, it's an emerging research area, is happening in the US where they call multi-generational workforce, where you have more and more elderly returning to the workplace and what kind of roles that they can play. So for Malaysia at the moment, we do not have a very clear retraining for older workers and workforce re-entry. We do not have that. Our neighbour Singapore have some similar programs where they actually have a retirement age, which is 62, but they have a re-employment age, which is up to 67. So they give employers some incentive for hiring older workers. But we are catching up. Just recently, we have passed amendments to the rules and regulations where employers can claim for tax rebates if they hire older workers at the age of 60 and above, or disabled workers, or ex-convicts. They have just passed that recently, and it will be applicable for tax rebates for 2019 and 2020. And this is a positive development because now employers can actually claim tax rebates for having staff that are age 60 and above. And hopefully, this will encourage employers to hire retirees who are clearly qualified for some jobs. And it has a very interesting ceiling as well. You can only claim this for any staff that you hire that the salary below 4,000 ringgit a month.
I see.
So it's a very interesting use of ceiling. So it means that if you're hiring a senior citizen for a 10,000 ringgit monthly job, probably you won't get that rebate. So they're trying to stimulate it at the right place, which I think is a good use of ceilings and limit.
And when we look at the demographics, you know, our elderly population is so segmented in terms of income, race, religion. How does all of that come into play here? You know, especially when we talk about how we can enact certain policies.
Yeah. Well, the first thing that my director, Professor Dato' Dr. Tengku Aizan, would say, please don't have policies where you just look at the older person. Take a life course perspective, because you are young before you're old. So we need to start working and addressing the issue of old age income security or health right from the younger ages, even from teenagers or primary school children, the importance of savings, compound interest, for example. Those are important concepts to be have, the importance of health insurance. So financial planning and all that are very, very important tools to have. But a lot of people seems to forget that when we institute some retirement savings policy like the EPF or any tax rebates, they're actually enjoying the benefits without realizing them. And that's the best form of policy. Of course, people grumble that a portion of the salary goes to EPF or some savings or SOCSO. But it provides coverage, and when you need it, you'll be glad. So it's a form of insurance, a risk pooling exercise. But when we ask government for incentives, for example, we try to return these incentives in the form of income tax rebates. But many of us forgot that what about those people who don't even qualify to be taxed? Then they won't be enjoying those tax breaks. So when the Bantuan Sara Hidup or BRIM was introduced, naturally we felt that it is a bit of a handout. But the idea and the principle that we have to understand is that do we have better mechanisms to really direct assistance to the group that needs them? Tax rebates will benefit the middle income group better. But for those who actually don't make enough to pay tax, the rebates are actually
right.
not going to be of any use to them.
Mm.
So this is where we need to relook at our approach and how do we actually reach the target groups that we that needed help the most at the right time when they need it. A lot of our financial assistance programs or rely on at least the person having a bank account, or they have to have a permanent address. You can't apply for many things without these two things. You know, you can't apply for assistance, for example. They were, you're required to have that. But what if you are a person who is bankrupt, you know, and you have no bank accounts, you can't open a bank account? Or what if you have a previous prison record and you can't do certain things? Or if you are living in the streets? So what kind of assistance is directed to these groups? Or you have what we call the transient poor. You lost your job or you lost your income or suddenly the breadwinner passes away. And what are the protection for these crisis that happens in the family and the household?
Mm.
So we need to relook at our approach to social protection. And it is related to old age preparedness protection. But I would say that at this juncture, the government is trying very hard.
And I mean, we in the past year alone, I think there have been, there appears to be some measures taken to safeguard this community even further. For example, last year, Parliament passed the Private Age Healthcare Facilities and Services Act 2018.
Yes.
And the minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Awitha Murthy, did say that the government is willing to look into a proposal for a new law to protect parents who are being neglected by their children. You know, but are these enough? Because you know, or is it too soon to tell? Because it has only been a year. You know, what are your thoughts on some of these legislations and proposals?
One thing we don't do very well in this country is actually evaluate the impact of our existing programs and services. That's something that is that we really need some assessment and evaluation on or monitoring. We have many programs with the different ministries. There are talks about consolidating them. But what we really need is actually assessing the impact of all these programs. Are they really reaching their supposed objectives and targets? Are they really performing as they should? So, and when we try to introduce new initiatives or new programs, did we pilot them? Did we make estimates and projections about the cost and sustainability of many of the programs? And when we roll out something, we seem to be in a hurry to do it nationwide. And this is something that I think is a broader issue of governance culture and how we approach our policies and programs. So, of course, periodical reviews are needed. We cannot rely on the Auditor General's report, because those are audit samples. You know, they are not meant to assess impact. They are meant to assess whether it has been carried out properly according to procedures.
Mm.
But they are not there to assess, let's say, whether certain programs are doing as they were intended. So in this case, that's why we have regular studies on residents in homes. You know, there are many studies that, that does that on a small scale basis. But what we need is coordinated efforts. Like in other countries, they have national surveys of older people. They have longitudinal surveys where they go back to the same elderly over time to assess, you know, the onset of diseases, the point of where they are vulnerable. So we need research information and coordination, actually, because without all these efforts, we are actually saying that, oh, it's not working. And then we say, let's do something else. But why isn't it working?
Mm.
Why isn't something achieving its intended results? EPF is going to probably be worth $1 trillion in a few years' time, or it is already. So the question here is that how can we improve its ability to deliver? And the transparency of data sharing, that's another issue. So I think I would say that are we doing enough? We are trying very best. Like I said, we don't really have much money to experiment at this juncture, because unlike developed countries, they have the resources to put in social pensions. We don't. So before we embark on any major scale programs or new policies, we must properly evaluate its need and justify the kind of money that we are putting in.
And when we look at some of these proposals, these policies, this legislation, you know, how can we successfully integrate them to, you know, to result in something that actually works?
I think the challenge here is always whether do we want to make incremental, measurable impact changes on a slowly base. You know, maybe we want to say, okay, let's fix this and improve it slowly, or we want to say that, you know, let's make a big decision here based on whatever data we have and reform the pension system, and we can do it together to justify and balance up the impact. But we need more collaborative and coordination on this. Older person is not just the responsibility of the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Women. It is the responsibility of the Ministry of Economy as well, Ministry of Finance. So this is probably where we need the council to be more active. We have a National Advisory and Consultative Council for Older Persons. It is chaired by the Minister of Women. But we need an inter-ministerial body that can actually look at these things on a broader scale. Minimum wages, for example, you might think that it has nothing much to do with the elderly. But for us, when it was introduced in 2012, we immediately recognized that it has a huge impact on retirement adequacy and preparedness. Because when you have minimum wages set, you can roughly project an increment every year, and you can see that how it will contribute to more savings in old age. This is a clear example of how something being done at one end of the spectrum that will have a huge cumulative impact 50 years or 40 years down the road. So similarly, with the income tax, the corporate tax or employer tax rebates for older workers, we foresee that it can have a huge impact, but we need to have the right incentives on the ground for employers to say, I want to hire a senior citizen for this job, not just for the tax rebate.
Yeah.
Nobody does that. So I think this is where we say coordinated initiatives has to be done. So it's not sufficient to just have the tax rebates for hiring older workers. We must also have a program where we encourage older workers to be retrained to go back to work.
Because of the skills gap that they now have, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Or we even just encourage lifelong learning where it's happening, but we don't have specific funds for that. And we seem to treat aging and old age issue as a welfare problem or a health problem. But it is way more than that. It's definitely an economic problem, and it's definitely a family issue as well. We have to understand the general trend today. We are talking about the care economy, and it is happening now in many developed countries because they recognize that it is a hidden sector. It has been performed for largely no cost by the families. But with commodification, they are starting to see all this increased value in the care economy because it's being privatized. It's being offloaded from the family to the marketplace. So this is where it gets interesting, because the care economy has always been a dead-end sector. You know, if you are a carer,
yeah,
there's really not much of a job prospect. So ILO and many of the OECD countries were trying to say, how can we make the care economy work? And it's actually really, care economy is also women's labour. A lot of it is still dominated by women without proper pay. Because you're either working on a part-time basis, they don't get coverage for health and all that. So how do we really improve all this on a national scale? And these are the discourse that has to be done at the different ministries. The Ministry of Health cannot say that I will also look into the care economy, but it has to be sustainable. and how do we protect wages for people who work in the social and health sectors. We already have the statistics by the Department of Statistics Malaysia that shows majority of the workers in the social work and health sectors are women. But they have lower salaries than men in the same sector.
Mm. Well, that's a whole lot of social things to unpack there, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and you mentioned multi-ministerial purview. So that was actually my next question. Which ministry do all of this fall under? But it's the Women and Family Ministry, right?
Yeah. In different countries, they have different arrangements. In Australia, they have a Ministry of Health and Ageing. So Singapore had the same arrangement where they actually have another minister for older persons. And do we need such political structures? Perhaps. It depends on our country's situation and our need. But what we should really have in terms of inter-ministerial coordination is that we need to make sure that there is a mechanism where policymakers can get evidence and input from data, whether it's through the universities or whether through their own in-house research institutes, where they can get the data to be put on the table for discussion and debate, and then form alternatives or initiatives where we can improve the situation. So we hope there's broad consultation before something is done. And this is what needs to happen for us at different levels. The National Policy for Older Persons have 7 subcommittees, and they are all led by different ministries. Ministry of Health would be leading the subcommittee on health, and then the Ministry of Education would be leading the one on education. But there needs to be more coordination between these subcommittees, and there need to be more intergenerational programs rather than looking at older persons in an isolation.
Mm.
We need to look at the programs from a broader perspective. And this is what has been advocated by the Institute for many, many years.
And the Malaysian Aging Research Network, or MARN, I mean, of course, they do play a role, I'm assuming, in researching this population and understanding their needs better. What do some of their recent findings say about the needs of the aging community here? And, you know, would we be able to address any of those needs soon?
That was really the reason why the Malaysian Aging Research Network was promoted and started. It was a very recent affair because we realized that we have many colleagues in different areas of research, and they might not be working with each other or knowing what's going on in, for example, the field of dentistry or in the field of nutrition, you know, the kind of developments that are happening. So we thought of and we convinced the with the support of the Ministry of Women, where we will try and have a network where we try and get the researchers together, whether they are from a government or from the universities or from the private sector or whatsoever, where we can actually have a way to slowly build up our multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary collaborations. So are there findings? Yes, the traditional avenue for research would be the journals.
Mm.
And as with any research, there are many studies on the needs of older persons, the kind of surveys that have been done. And it will always be health and financial.
Right.
We need to talk about researchers collaborating or sharing their findings. And more importantly, if it is a public-funded research, there has to be a mechanism where the data will be available for researchers to mine and to see whether there are other values or replication of studies that has been done previously. So I think this is how it can be done, because different generation will have different needs. If you ask the elderly today and you ask an elderly maybe 10, 20 years down the road, you have a very different scenario. We are all talking about the silver industry now because the incoming group of baby boomers really have spending power and they have savings. But how do we balance up the situation, let's say 50 years down the road, when we are looking at the young people today who cannot afford homes?
Yeah.
So we have to realize that pure science research, applied sciences or whatsoever, is really different from social sciences and humanities. So knowing these differences, that we hope, whether it's through the Malaysian Aging Research Network or the one that is being promoted by the National Population and Family Development Board recently, there will be an ASEAN research networking on aging that is being done at the moment. We hope to also learn from other countries with similar development, economic development background, and see how they solve their problems or how they address their population aging issues. Then perhaps we can learn one or two lessons from their experience and not to grope in the dark about how it will turn out.
And as you mentioned, the ASEAN-wide research network on aging, where you know the aim is to establish a common, a cohesive and sustainable ASEAN research agenda on issues pertaining to aging. Can you explain to me how this project is being carried out? You know, are all the ASEAN countries involved?
Well, it's really very new. It's just last year we had our first work, this year where we just had our first workshop. And what we did was, this is funded through ASEAN and JIVE, Japan funding through ASEAN. And what they did was, we tried to identify the focal points on aging in different countries in the region. So most likely through the government departments and all that. But as you are aware, there's always a disconnect between government ministries and researchers. They are not exactly the same one and same thing. So the entire idea behind this ASEAN research network is that we identify the focal point for the different governments. And then what we do is we try and engage the researchers in these different countries to actually form a platform where we identify national priorities and then regional priorities. Why do we say regional priorities? We are in a very interesting phase. Of course, we can look at Singapore and then you have the Johor issue where many Singaporean elderly are being put in Johor homes. We call them trans-border care.
Right.
Or we talk, I mean, there are issues related to visa arrangements. It is a lucrative business, but there are other issues with it. How is it going to be regulated? How is it going to be monitored? The risk assessment has to be there. But in the ASEAN level, we have something more interesting than that because we have Philippines and Indonesia who are exporting migrant care workers to Japan, to our country, to Singapore. And they are working on all kinds of training and certification to make sure that these care workers are international, or we call them migrant care workers, are qualified to perform certain tasks in this emerging residential business. Malaysia probably don't feel it yet, but in Japan, it is a major market where they have a very stringent process where if you want to be a care worker in Japan for one of these old folks' homes, you have to have language fluency tests. And then you need to go through a training to understand the culture. And this is something very, very interesting because the care economy is global. And we know we are losing nurses to Middle East countries. That has been happening for many, many years.
Right.
But similarly, could you imagine that these countries are losing their care workers, young women, you know, to other countries when their own country is aging? So who will really be taking care of them? So these are major regional issues that has to be considered, including the protection of migrant care workers, including domestic maids. Because over here, we have a very unique solution that no other Western countries really do. They don't have domestic help us over there. It's impossible to hire someone and make you live in and then ask them to take care of your parent. That is not something that's very common overseas. But we have that arrangement. But how well do we protect our domestic workers? And this is also an ongoing issue. So perhaps when we talk about carers, care workers, when we commercialize and commodify the work, we have to make sure that we do not exploit this foreign labor and we accord them the same protection and minimum wage like other foreign workers, which they do not get now at the moment.
Yeah. And, you know, when we look at some of the findings, for example, from the Malaysian Aging Research Institute and even now with the ASEAN Research Network, you know, how can data like this be used to help bridge that gaps in policy, research and practice, especially in our current administration locally, not just from a regional perspective, but specifically here?
It really depends on the kind of political will that we have in making those decisions. Japan, for example, in the 1990s, took a radical approach to their social protection system and they introduced long-term care insurance. All these require long-term planning and commitment. and a change in the structure of funding and administration. For us, Malaysia, we do not have local government elections. Our local authorities are more focused on physical aspects of residential needs, whereas in other countries, local authorities cover all aspects from health to education to care. So when we want to adopt or learn from all these foreign initiatives, we must bear in mind that they have a very different administrative structure right down to the local level. So we need to look back at our current federal and state government structures and ask ourselves, when you do a national policy for older persons, is it really filtered down through the local government level and initiatives are happening on a interdepartmental level and not just through the district offices of welfare office or district clinics, healthcare clinics, which is what's happening now. The local authority must be involved, the district office as well. But with all these structures, we have to understand that we are hampered by a different mechanism, funding structure. So these are policy issues that has to be resolved through the administration approach. No amount of research can sway them unless they decide that something has to be done. So evidence needs to be compiled and collected, and alternatives need to be shown. So I do believe that the new government represents a lot of hope and expectations that things will change, how things will be done. But I think the fundamentals has to be addressed. We need to have a broader consultative effort. We have to encourage public debate and discourse about the choices that we make. And this is something that is still, we need more space for that. We need more funding for that. And if the government can say, oh, let us, you know, coordinate all these expertise that we have, these researchers that we have in the Malaysian Aging Research Network, in all these public universities or private universities. There's a Joran Technology Lab at Monash, a private university. So if we coordinate the kind of expertise and resource that we have, and then we say that, you know, rather than you doing independent studies in silos or whatsoever, let's have a coordinated national program like the National Institute of Aging in the US, where they are funded and coordinated so that we can avoid duplication.
Yeah.
That would not just save us money, but it will also help us to say, how is this data linked to another? How can we have a common data set where we look at different aspects of aging in a more comprehensive manner? So I think this is where many things can happen, but it will just take a lot of coordination and political will to decide that, you know, we need to do this not just for aging studies, but we also need to do this for child studies, for education, where we actually coordinate some aspects of this research and say that let's try and form a bigger picture together. Every researcher can still do whatever that they're good at, but we try and complement a broader, a more directed picture. So probably we hope the government not just have economic advisors for the economy, but they also have social advisors to plan out research for community, family, and the society needs. So I think we have a lot of potentials that we can do, but we need to have the will to actually put in place all this structure where we can collaborate and where we can share our findings.
So a lot of important key takeaways from, you know, what we just discussed. And we are running out of time, but, you know, before we leave, do you have a final message you'd like to share?
Well, I'm from the Malaysian Research Institute of Aging, so naturally I hope that there will be more research in the field, you know, a more robust approach to how we use research data, how it can be shared more openly, how researchers can gain access to administrative data. That would be amazing, because we are talking about big data approaches nowadays. Actually, government is sitting on troves and troves of invaluable information that they have collected over the years. The question here is always, how do we make use of that information? Corporations are starting to learn that they can do that now. they are starting to mine their own customers' data. That's what Facebook is doing. That's what Google is doing.
Mm.
But governments have been sitting on those data for hundreds of years in some cases. For us, it's probably much shorter. But we have very good administrative data, and we often underestimated its potential and how it can inform public policy. So perhaps my parting message would be we need a coordinated effort, because we cannot afford to replicate studies, you know, duplicate efforts. We need to actually coordinate them. And hopefully this is the way forward for all different fields of studies in this country, where researchers in a field could collaborate and exchange more about what their work that they have been doing and how they can find room to collaborate, because different fields actually are very, very much connected than it appears.
Yeah. And I suppose we'll also have to see how the current administration continues to further develop policies that that prepares us for an aging nation status.
Evidence-based.
Yes, evidence-based exactly. Policymaking, yes. Yeah. Thank you for joining me on the show today, Chai. I have been speaking to Chai Sen Ting. He is a senior research officer with the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging from University Putra, Malaysia. We were talking about the role of gerontology in bridging gaps in policy. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.